Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This episode is sponsored by Vivo Life. If you want to give yourself a boost, try Vivo Life's multi-nutrient supplement, Thrive. We all know the importance of a healthy diet, but sometimes our busy lifestyles mean that it can be difficult to get all the nutrients that our body needs every day. This is why I'm so happy to have found Vivo Life's Thrive, a revolutionary health supplement that has all the power of a multivitamin, but is a plant-based blend of vitamins, minerals, probiotics, and superfoods expertly formulated by nutritionists. Thrive is packed with 12 organic fruits and vegetables, medicinal mushrooms, and 15 key vitamins and minerals to boost your immune system and strengthen your natural defenses. There are also 10 billion probiotics in each scoop. Try Thrive today and use the code TALKINGTASTEBUDS at the checkout to receive 10% off your order. Welcome back to Talking Taste Buds Season 6. I'm Venetia Lamanna, and in this series I chat to inspiring thinkers and leaders who encourage people like you and me to live a conscious and full life. If you're new here, please do subscribe, rate and review. It makes a massive difference in chart positions and ultimately getting the word of the podcast out there. Kimberly Wilson is a chartered psychologist and visiting lecturer working in private practice in central London. Her work looks at the role food and lifestyle plays in our mental health, including disordered eating, the gut-brain axis, and our emotional relationship with food. Her debut book, How to Build a Healthy Brain, Reduce Stress, Anxiety, and Depression, and Future-Proof Your Brain, is available now, and I cannot recommend it enough. I've left a link to it in the show notes. Last week, I caught up with Kimberly on video chat to bring you this episode on mental health, brain function, and how we can look after ourselves during isolation, touching on social media, the news, sleep, food, exercise, and much more. Kimberly gives us so much useful and actionable advice in this episode, for which I'm so grateful. Without further ado, here is Kimberly Wilson on Talking Taste Buds.
Now, let us start as we always do. What did you have for breakfast?
So this morning I had a multigrain porridge with blueberries and banana, a little bit of cinnamon. So yeah, a nice oaty way to start the day.
I too had oats this morning. Can't get enough of them. Now, I'd love to hear a little bit about your journey. I'd love to hear about where you grew up, and also the kind of food you grew up eating and your strongest memories of food, and whether or not you kind of cared about food when you were growing up.
So I'm a Londoner through and through, and I grew up eating a mixture of West Indian food and British food, because my parents were from the West, well, my grandparents were from the West Indies. And so for me, it was always a mixture of those really familiar family foods, you know, jerk chicken and fried chicken, fried fish, rice and peas, ackee and saltfish, and then, you know, well, British and Mediterranean foods, pastas and cottage pies and all of those sorts of things. And obviously a hybrid of the two. So everything was always a little bit spicier. And there was this, it was really lovely, me and a friend of mine, and he's Pakistani by background. And we were talking about how both of our respective communities add onions and spices to baked beans. Like, it was just a natural thing for us to do. So that's kind of my food history. I think I've always liked food. Like, I was never a fussy eater. I always liked food, enjoyed food. And then I think as I got older, I was interested in the processes of food. And I think with that mixed cultural heritage, always interested in the way that different people ate and different types of food and why certain foods were common from different parts of the world and what they began to mean to people. And I remember even at nursery, I had a like really cool nursery where we, for Chinese New Year, we were all of us, so we were all kind of a mixed group of children, mixed heritage. But we were all taught to use chopsticks, you know, because we were going through and experiencing the foods and cultures of different members of the group. So yeah, food has always been that for me, a kind of window or doorway into culture and heritage and other people's stories.
I absolutely love that. And I think we can already hear how intelligent and analytical your mind is. So when was it that you decided you wanted to get into psychology, and when did your kind of fascination with the brain and the mind begin?
So pretty early. So there's, I kind of say in the kind of opening page of my book, there's a lot of neurological illness in my family. And so I grew up with this very automatic, very present awareness of brains, really. Like I was aware that the brain is a thing and stuff happens in it, and some of that stuff is good and some of it is not good, and it can come out in this way, you know, in a very kind of simplistic understanding of it. So I guess I always had an awareness. And then as I got older, I suppose that puts you in a bit of an analytical position as a student. And then I did A-level psychology, was the first opportunity to really study it, and just loved it. Like I was just fascinated. And they always start you with the good stuff. They always start you with what was at the time called abnormal psychology. And you get to hear about really interesting strain syndromes, like Capgras syndrome, and you know, where people believe that they're dead. Yep. Wow. And you know, things like phantom limb, where people can still continue to have sensation in an amputated limb. And it's kind of all of this really fascinating information about what is the most complex organ in the entire universe, you know, the most complex system known to man, but resides inside your own head. And I love that kind of contrast, is that it's so complex, it's so unknown, but we each have one. Isn't it amazing? So I knew very early on that I wanted to go into psychology. So yeah, as I said, I chose it at A level because I thought I'm very interested in this, and then it was a very, very straight route for me. I kind of did my levels, did my undergrad, then came back because I did my undergrad up in the north, and then came back and did my postgrad and then another master's, and then started working.
I loved hearing about how you've kind of been on this mission for a while and you've been so kind of clear on what you wanted to do. And I am so grateful to have a copy of your book, How to Build a Healthy Brain. I should say that this was a pre-release copy, so I feel like I am in The Devil Wears Prada with that pre-release copy of the Harry Potter manuscript. That's how I felt when I received it anyway. I was like, I am ahead of the curve with this. I loved it. But it's such an incredible book and it's so dense, and I couldn't believe one of the stats or one of the facts that you kind of lead within the book, which is in 10 years depression will be the leading cause of global disease burden, which is a measure of how much an illness affects the quality of life expectancy and the economy. So why is our lack of understanding and treatment of mental health having such a huge impact?
Okay. That's a big old question. I think there are a few reasons that despite being one of the leading causes of disease and disability across the world, not just in the UK, across the world, that the brain is neglected. And I think part of it is historical. So part of it is because we have this idea of the mind being separate, being ethereal, somewhere out there, disconnected from the body. And therefore, if something goes wrong with the mind, then it can't have anything to do with the body. We can't fix it through normal means. We have to pursue other means, right? So right in the beginning, that used to be possession, ideas of possession and demons. And then it was, you know, humors and all of this sort of stuff, rather than this is an organ. The mind is a function of the brain. The brain is an organ, and therefore if there's something wrong with the mind, we need to pay some attention to the organ that underlies it. So there's a bit of this separation, we call it a Cartesian dualism between the brain and the body. And what that means is that it just gets neglected. People just don't think about it. And it's the brain on top of that is very out of sight, out of mind, right? So if you start to perhaps not look after yourself, the effects of that show very quickly in your body, right? Whether it's in changes in your, I don't know, skin texture, or if you put on or lose weight, all sorts of things, it's very evident. But because your brain is hidden behind your skull, you know, you're not looking at it, you can't see it, it's much less available. You can't look at the signs and think, oh, my brain is struggling, maybe I should look after it a little bit better. So I think that's the second reason. It's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And then I think the third reason is just the pervasive stigma around mental health, mental illness. We still, in this very, very bizarre way, feel as though it's a moral failing if you have a mental health concern, you know, as if it's that you just haven't been strong enough, you just haven't tried enough, you have a weak constitution, there's something wrong with you. And it's so bizarre, because as I say, the brain is the most complex organ in the world, right? It's more complex than your phone, and as soon as your phone breaks down, you look on online for ways to fix it, you take it to the shop, you know, you realize that it's a complex thing, you can't fix it yourself, so you better take it to someone trained to do it. But bizarrely, with the brain, we say, well, I am my brain, I am me, and therefore I should be able to fix it from the inside. And so it's this really strange misunderstanding about how the brain works, how complex it is, how little insight we have into our own minds, that makes people think, well, if something goes wrong with my brain, I should just push through, rather than treat it like any other health condition and go and see a professional as soon as possible.
There's so much mental health advocacy now online, and I do think there has been a real shift in us talking about our mental health. Do you feel encouraged by that kind of movement, and also do you have any concerns about it?
So I think, as with many things, there are positives and negatives. So I think it's great, particularly with higher profile people talking about the realities of mental health concerns, because one of the things, as I say, is that it kind of, people take the attitude of mental illness as a moral failing, but we look up to our celebrities, our stars, we bestow them with a greater sense of moral fortitude and, you know, goodness. And so if someone in that position, someone who is a role model, can say, well, this happened to me, then it really does, I think, help to break down the stigma and the boundaries that hold people back from talking about it or seeking help. I think where that crosses over into being less helpful and possibly dangerous is when someone in that position, particularly someone with a big following, says, well, this is what worked for me, and therefore you should do this. You know, I accept that people don't do it maliciously and they're genuinely trying to help, but it comes down to the kind of Dunning-Kruger effect, which is you don't know what you don't know. And so if you have had your own experience with depression and maybe, I don't know, doing an exercise regime or, you know, whatever helped you, that's fantastic. And that's a useful piece of information that we can put together into a bigger kind of body of information for the general public. But it doesn't mean that all depression is fixed with that thing. And it can be quite dangerous to start to suggest those kinds of things, because when people feel bad, and if they don't feel in a position to be able to ask a professional for help if they feel very ashamed about it, they will try to fix it by themselves. And they will go to people with big followings and take their advice. And both parties might not know that they're completely missing the mark. And so that's when it becomes dangerous, because the longer we leave a mental health condition without the proper treatment, the more entrenched it becomes, the harder it is to come back to baseline, and actually the longer the person suffers. So it's pluses and minuses.
So it's good to kind of feel like, I think it's probably good in the sense that you've realized that you're not alone and that everyone has their own struggles, but mm-hmm. but to know that not one size fits all when it comes to mental health, and to seek out your own help. Cool, perfect. So tell us about your whole body mental health philosophy.
So it comes down to the basic idea that this historical way that we've looked at the brain, you know, as separate from the body, is this kind of brain in a jar, doesn't make sense. It's completely wrong. And we need to stop doing that if we're going to help people, more people, achieve real recovery from mental illness. Because one of the things that happens with mental illness is that whilst we try to cure or to put physical illnesses into remission, right? So if someone has, someone is at risk of diabetes, for example, we might say, here's the things you need to do, you know, change your diet, exercise more, reduce these risk factors, and we'll get your blood glucose back to a normal level. That's what we try to do with physical illness. What we try to do for the most part with mental illness is to stop it getting worse. Right, we don't come to a position of, oh, we can get you back to a place where you feel good. We just go, oh, we'll stop your depression from becoming extreme or severe or hugely intense. We don't take that position of, we think you can recover from this. We think you can come back to a place where you don't feel chronically depressed all the time. I think that does patients and clients a massive disservice. And I think it also, by only looking at the brain separately, misses all of the complex but really well-established ways that the body affects the brain. The way that your food and your nutrition and the nutrients that you can take in affects the brain. How your gut microbiome can affect the conditions in your body, and that can affect the brain. How levels of exercise can protect you from depression. All of these things are well-established in the literature. We know it, it's been there for years and years, yet we don't incorporate the body when we're thinking about improving people's mental health. It doesn't make sense to me, and I think it leaves people with huge chunks of information missing from their care plans.
Absolutely, and that leads us really nicely on to the kind of next set of questions, which I have framed. They're all about overall well-being that you've just spoken about, but I'm kind of putting an isolation spin on them because of the time that we're currently in.
Of course.
But even if you're listening when we're not in lockdown, which will hopefully be sooner than we all expect, the answers will absolutely still be relevant, because this is overall health forever, not just in lockdown. But that's the kind of spin that I'd love us to kind of focus on a little bit.
Sure.
So how can we protect our mental health when we're isolating and when we are kind of more attached to our devices than we usually would be, because we want to feel connected, but the news is just so overwhelming? And perhaps we could talk a little bit about social media and kind of boundaries that we should be setting as well. I mean, is this a time to be online all the time? It's kind of really hard to strike that balance.
Yeah, so there's lots of things to think about there. And I think, and I've certainly seen it in, so we went, I don't know when this is going out, but we went officially into lockdown yesterday, but it's been coming, I think, for a few weeks. And what I've seen in clinic are just slowly increasing higher and higher and higher levels of anxiety. And I think that's what we're all experiencing on a global national level, that there's a kind of sea level rise in everybody's general anxiety. And that's one of the things that I'd really want people to be thinking about at the moment. And we talk about flattening the curve of the cases, but I really would like to be people to I'd really like people to be thinking about flattening the curve on the anxiety, right? Because in the same way as you get these really high peaks in the cases, so everyone hopefully has seen the graph, you know, at the peak of anxiety are things like catastrophizing, paralysis because you don't know what to do, or impulsivity, all of which are quite dangerous if you need to think rationally and make good decisions. At the bottom of anxiety is a kind of blasé attitude where nothing really matters, you can do what you like, and that puts us all at risk as well. So there's almost a way in which we need a kind of middle way, which is you need to be aware enough to keep yourself safe and do sensible things, but not so inundated with information that it kind of paralyzes you and makes it impossible for you to think straight. So one of the things that I have very much been advising my clients is really, really, really to limit the news outlets that you're following and the number of times that you're checking it in the day. And I think there's a way in which people feel like, or they hope, that getting more information will make them feel safer. You know, the more that I know, the better edge I will have, the better decisions I can make, and the safer I will be. But the reality is that what you're getting is not more information, because information comes in kind of from the official announcements at the end of the day from Boris, right? That's the information you should be listening to, or wherever this goes out to, that your official outlets for information. Everything else is opinion, conjecture, supposition, and anxiety. So actually, if you're constantly scrolling through other people's opinions, you know, their takes on it, how it's affecting this industry, how it's affecting that industry, all you're doing is filling yourself up on other people's anxieties, and you don't have the space for that right now, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe at other times in your life you can do that, but we don't have the space for it right now. And what I'm really speaking to my clients about is, you know, you need to have a spring clean of your brain of other people's anxieties, and then we need to think quite clearly about how we manage yours. So I would be saying, no, you really don't need to be constantly scrolling through Twitter, you know, downloading the news apps and turning on all of the notifications, and then having like rolling news on in the background. That is not going to help you. You want to choose maybe one or two official updates and check them no more than twice a day, right? So maybe once in the morning and then once in the afternoon, not just before bed, please don't do that. so that you are limiting the kind of windows in which you're exposing yourself to this kind of anxiety. And then after that, so once you've got yourself into a habit of kind of almost news hygiene, you know, you've kind of tidied that up a little bit, then you want to focus on the things that you can control. And that's, I think, hugely important at the moment, because so much of this situation is uncertain and it's out of our control, and we feel powerless and we feel helpless. And there's a huge loss involved in losing that sense of predictability and certainty in your life, you know, so that in all other, I was looking tomorrow, I was supposed to be having lunch with a friend and we'd booked it a month ago. And, you know, at that time, we thought we could predict where we would be in a month's time. And we thought we could rely on the fact that we'd be able to make that meeting, and we can't now. And that is happening on an extremely intense level for everybody around the planet, that we don't even know where we're going to be next week. You know, this time last week, I saw a client in person. Now, not a possibility, can't even leave my house twice a day, right? Mm-hmm. So that things are changing so, so rapidly. And I think there can be a tendency for people to want to grasp on and hold on to a sense of certainty. But actually what's needed right now, which isn't easy, but is I think necessary, is a kind of surrender to the uncertainty and the things that you absolutely can't control, because you will hurt yourself trying to control them or telling yourself you can control them. And then to balance that, a focus on the things that you can control. So you can control your routine. You know, you can control what time you get up, whether you go outside, you know, get some natural light, get some fresh air, get some movement. All of those are going to be really good for you physiologically in managing your stress. You can control, well, to a degree, what's on the shelves, but you know, what you eat, but making sure you're having, you know, regular meals, as nutritious as possible, because again, essentially a well-nourished brain can tolerate stress much better. That's what we know. You know, so if you're undernourished, you are going to experience more stress and you're going to suffer from it more than someone who is kind of better nourished. So that's what you can control. You can, as I say, control the amount of information that you're taking in, and to limit that as a source of stress. You can control, you know, the other thing is it doesn't all have to be suffering. So I would be recommending people watch comedy shows, like watch things that you enjoy. You know, you're allowed to laugh. This is awful. It's scary. It's frightening. But you are allowed to have some moments of normality, and they are going to be so important for anchoring you in this time, which feels very, very unsettling. So those are kind of some, oh, and sleep, right? And making sure that you're maintaining a good sleep routine, because again, the worse your sleep, or the more underslept you are, the greater your sense of paranoia, the greater your sense of anxiety. So we're already anxious. We don't want you to feeling even more anxious. So making sure you're at least trying to keep a good sleep routine is really going to help with that physiological and psychological resilience to what's happening to us at the moment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I love that you've brought up watching comedy, because I'm pissed off with Netflix right now. Every time I log in, it just wants me to watch the show called Pandemic. Piss off. I do not want to watch a show or a documentary or whatever it is called Pandemic. Let me watch Friends and just...
Watch reruns of Friends. I
know how problematic it is, but right now it's familiar and that's what I need.
Well, I think that's really important. Like, take yourself back, even if it's for half an hour, to a place that feels familiar and safe. Like, we will all need these anchors of safety. And I say anchors because I feel like we are a bit at sea, right? We're all feeling a little bit lost. We're treading water. We're not really sure what's happening. Things could change in a moment. We kind of hit this massive corona iceberg and nobody really knows what's going on. But that these parts of your routine, these things that feel familiar, these things that feel comforting, these moments of connection with your community are the things that are going to give you a sense of stability when everything feels unstable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm so pleased that you brought up sleep. I personally am sleeping more than ever at the moment, and I'm telling myself it's okay because I need it. But let's talk about sleep. Mm. Can you explain what a chronotype is? And how it informs how much sleep we need and when we need to be getting that sleep.
Yes. So your chronotype is your general tendency to be an early riser, or a lark, as we call them in the literature, or a late riser, which are called owls, you know. So morning larks, night owls, morning people, evening people. And the tendency can also be called morningness or eveningness. And so your larks are your traditional up at 5 a.m., 6 a.m. people, bright and breezy, feeling fantastic, like the people you don't want to be around if you've got a hangover, like, hello, those are your larks. They feel great first thing. They feel most sharp first thing. Their brain is ticking over very nicely. They feel very efficient and productive at those times. Then your night owls have a later, there's like a phase shift in their circadian rhythm, so that all of those things happen for them, but later in the day. So they might feel best waking up around 8 or 9, and then actually their brains are kicking in around 11 o'clock or maybe even later. Some people are extreme owls, might kick in, you know, some people feel most productive around midnight, and actually then they're getting their 8 hours sleep from something like midnight till 8 or 2 till 10 or whatever. It can vary between individuals, but it's stable within individuals because it's predominantly genetically encoded. So if you are a morning person, you are a morning person, and if you're a night owl, you are a night owl. And you can do little things, you can kind of shift it around the edges, but you fundamentally, if I think I'm an in the middle person, but I think I tendency to night, I cannot make myself a morning person just by forcing myself to get up at 5 or 6 in the morning, because what will happen is that my brain will be fighting me. It wants to be asleep, it doesn't want to be up doing stuff, and what will happen is that I will have pushed myself out of a time when I should be getting good sleep. So actually I'm depriving myself of good sleep. I'm making my brain work harder. Because it's working harder, there's higher perceived effort, which means everything is just a bit more tiring and I'm a bit more miserable. So there's no real benefit in trying to force yourself to be a morning person if you're not a morning person. The difficulty with that is that our society is very much built around morning people. So whether that's school opening times or whether that's work start times, people really, depending on their commute, need to be up around 6:30 in order to be starting their days. And that works very well for larks. It doesn't work great for teenagers who all, when we're teenagers, we all shift into being owls, or kind of naturally owl adults.
I interviewed someone yesterday and she said her son was still in bed and it was 2 o'clock when I interviewed her. And I was like, I remember those days.
Right?
Oh my God.
You weren't being lazy. It was just, this is what happened. It was your body just shifts you.
It was my chronotype.
Yeah.
At that point.
That's what
let's talk a little bit about physical activity and how it can impact our brain and our overall health. Currently, I am trying to go out for very kind of distanced walks. And honestly, I don't know how I would maintain my mental health if I wasn't allowed to go for a walk. So what is it about physical activity that kind of benefits our brain health and mental health so much?
So many things. Right. So first up, exercise can improve your sleep quality. And sleep quality is so good for the brain. I'm like, there's so much about why sleep is good for the brain. Good sleep can help protect you against dementia and so forth. So first up, exercise helps improve your sleep. And the knock-on effects of that is that good sleep is good for the brain. Second of all, aerobic activity, any movement that gets your heart pumping, helps to keep those tiny blood vessels that keep your brain supplied with nutrients and oxygen, energy, flexible and open. And obviously we want that to happen because the more your brain can get access to those things, the better it can function, the better it can protect itself, the better you will feel. And you get protection against things called something called vascular dementia, which is the kind of dementia that occurs when those blood vessels get tight or blocked, and then the brain damage that occurs from that. With resistance exercise, so we hear a lot about aerobic exercise, but with resistance exercise, what happens is that the same chemicals, so when you lift weights, you release a whole bunch of growth factors that help your muscles to repair and grow stronger the next time. Those same growth factors help your brain to build new connections, which is incredible.
That's
because
amazing.
It's so good.
So cool.
And that's really important because what we do know is that your brain starts to shrink by about 1% a year from, it's not great. From about your 50s and 60s, right? Wow. And that's considered normal. I think I say in the book that I don't think we should consider it normal, but it's considered normal. But that shrinking is associated with the kind of normal, in inverted commas, forgetfulness we get as we get older. So, oh, you've forgotten where you put your keys, oh, it must be my age. But actually that's associated with loss of brain volume. And what we know is that regular exercise can increase your brain volume by about 1-2%. So if you're a regular exerciser, you can effectively be reversing brain aging. So it's really, really important. And then I guess a final point, if you need more reasons to move, is that, and perhaps people have heard a lot about inflammation. I talk about inflammation a lot in the book, the body's immune response, which is fine when it's in a normal, acute and self-regulating state, but not good if it goes on for a very, very long time and isn't checked. And then, because what can happen is that inflammation in the body can trigger inflammation in the brain. And that's called neuroinflammation. And neuroinflammation is associated with things like depression, like multiple sclerosis, like dementia, all sorts of neurological conditions. And what exercise can do is to take out of the bloodstream toxic compounds that occur in the body when you're in a state of chronic inflammation. So it can essentially kind of soak up compounds that would otherwise hurt the brain. So many reasons why exercise is really important for the brain. And that's one of the reasons that I say we should be thinking about whole body mental health, because we're moving away from the idea that you should exercise just to be thin or just because of aesthetics. And people perhaps find it difficult to then be motivated, because we're so used to being motivated to move because of that, which is a real shame, because mm-hmm. we'd like people to be moving because it feels good and it gives them a sense of autonomy and it makes them feel strong and whatever. But perhaps if it's helpful to think, if I'm moving, I'm protecting my mental health, not just now, but for years to come, then maybe that's a bit more a healthy motivation for people to think about getting out, even if it's just for like a 5-10 minute walk.
Absolutely. I think that will resonate for so many people. So is it about kind of, especially at the moment, like finding exercise that you love and that makes you feel good and just doing it when you can?
It's always about that. It's always about doing the things that feel good for you and that are sustainable. But it's also about making the point that some of the most startling and some of my favorite research has been around the impacts of just walking and how a 10-20 minute walk can reduce people's risk of dementia by 10, 20, sometimes 40%. So it doesn't have to be extreme. It doesn't have to be intense. It doesn't have to be high impact. Basically, every time you move, your body gets a boost, your brain gets a boost, you know, your brain likes you to move. And so any movement that you do and that you enjoy and that you can do on a regular basis is going to be doing your brain some good, except being hit in the head, which is, so in the book, I talk about the risks that come with things like boxing and other things where you have a high risk of concussion. So that's really the only downsides of body contact sports is the risk then of brain damage, but that's it's a smaller population. So
okay, cool. Let us talk a little bit about food and nutrition. I think it's something that my listeners are pretty clued up when it comes to their own nutrition and the kind of things that they should be eating. But I'd love to talk a little bit about the gut brain axis, which again might be a kind of nice way of looking at this kind of thing, like physical activity, from a different angle. So could you talk to us a little bit about the gut brain axis?
Yeah, so the gut brain axis is the term given for the structural and functional connection between the brain and the gut. And so the brain and the gut can communicate with each other in a few different ways. So sometimes that's through the compounds that our gut bacteria make. So they can make vitamins for us, they can synthesize neurotransmitters for us, they can help us digest certain things, and those things can travel in the bloodstream and communicate with the brain. But the main form of communication between the brain and the gut is a long, beautiful nerve called the vagus nerve, and it is it's fantastic. I love it. My favorite nerve, if anyone has a favorite nerve. And what it does, so it kind of goes, it comes down from the base of the skull, and it goes down, it kind of loops down the back of your throat, down the back of your voice box, into your heart, into your lungs. It controls or influences your heart rate and your breathing rate. It connects into the liver and the stomach, the kidneys, and then finishes down in the gut. And this is the main point of communication, the main structural form of communication. And I always say, if you think about it as a motorway with 10 lanes, if you think about this nerve as this motorway between your brain and your gut, then about 7 or 8 of those lanes are going upwards. So most of the nerves are going from the body to the brain. The brain is always monitoring and getting information about what's happening in the body. So it's not just the brain is telling the body what to do. The body is relaying back information to the brain that the brain then has to synthesize and make sense of and then make actions of. The other thing about the vagus nerve is that it's the main structural component of what's called the parasympathetic nervous system. And that is the opposite. So most people have heard of the fight or flight system, you know, the thing that kicks in when we feel anxious, when we feel worried, when we need to kind of get away from danger. And the opposite of that is the parasympathetic nervous system, or the rest and digest system. So that's what kicks in when we're in a state of relaxation, a state of calm, peace, when we want to eat, and when everything is okay. And the thing about these two things, these two systems, is that they can't work at the same time. It's like a seesaw. Like, only one can be in control at the same time. And so if you're stressed and anxious and in a fight or flight mode, you won't be able to digest your food properly. And that's one of the reasons that we see such a strong relationship between stress and conditions like IBS, right? Because you're trying to do two opposing things at the same time. You cannot be stressed and try to eat. Your body, it has lots of different responses to stress that make digestion kind of impossible. And so it's one of the reasons that people really need to get around the idea that if, for example, they're having lots of gut symptoms, it might not necessarily be about the food. It might be about what's happening emotionally for them or in terms of their anxiety. So we really would be thinking about how you're managing your stress, what's going on for you, what state are you in before you eat, and do your symptoms go away when you're on holiday, but they're only there when you've got a big, you know, presentation to give at work. So there's really beautiful ways in which they're related. And I think it's really helpful for people to know that there's this really strong connection between these two things.
I love that. I think that will resonate with so many people. If someone's listening and thinking, I really want to get help, but I have no idea where to go for said help. And also, you know, there are so many stories of people who really need therapy and help from psychologists who just aren't able to access it if they don't have the money, because it can be super expensive. What's your kind of go-to advice for that?
It's really, really tough. And our provision for mental health treatment is not great and has been really cut back in the last few years. So even when I was training, NHS psychotherapy services were being cut by 30%. And these are treatments that have been shown to work, are effective for treating depression, and yet they're kind of the first thing to go when money gets tight. So I really understand that it's very, very difficult. The first thing would be is, you know, always try and speak to your GP, because you might get lucky. It's very much a postcode lottery. You might get lucky in that maybe there's really good provision in your area. Quite often the third sector, the voluntary sector, is available, and there might be very good voluntary provision. So that's a good place to try. The other place is actually to try and speak to, so first your GP, then charities like Mind, and other local community charities, often ones that are associated with your council, will have information about whether they offer therapy. And then also it's always worth speaking to training organizations. So you might want to go and speak to, for example, let's say the British Council of Psychotherapy, because what they do when their trainees have had a few years of experience of training, so late stage trainees, third or fourth years, they will need to get clinical experience. And in order to do that, very often they will work for free or at very low costs. And so you can get access to affordable therapy that way. If you can go straight to either the organisation, sometimes they might ask you to go to your GP, but often you can go direct to them. For people in London, on my Instagram, I have a highlight which has resources for low cost and free therapy in London. But I would try those areas, those three kind of ideas first, I think.
Lovely. And I should say at this point that if you don't yet follow Kimberly on Instagram, please do, because she's got one of the best accounts out there, in my humble opinion, if anyone cares my opinion. Kimberly, please tell me, what are your three kitchen essentials? These are three ingredients that, knowing you have them in your kitchen, make you feel more relaxed about life.
Garlic, plenty of garlic, chili, and lemons.
Brilliant answers. How would you feel about a quick fire round?
Let's go for it.
Quick fire with Kimberly. Breakfast, lunch, or dinner?
Breakfast.
Green tea or coffee?
Ooh, that's surprising. Green tea.
Walk or run?
Run.
Croissants or pancakes?
Pancakes.
Jam or Marmite?
Jam.
Lemons or limes?
Lemons.
Chili or garlic?
Chili. I'm so sorry.
Cupcakes or brownies?
Brownies.
Scones or crumpets?
Crumpets.
Banana bread or carrot cake?
Banana bread.
Victoria sponge or coffee and walnut cake?
Ugh, coffee and walnut cake is the worst. That was really a funny story, was that in the audition for Bake Off, they basically make you go through all of the challenges, and so you end up at one point having to make a recipe of Paul's and a recipe of Mary's, and Mary's was a coffee and walnut cake, and I couldn't even taste it. I was like, I hate it so much.
I can't believe you did that to Mary Berry. That proves how much you hate it. Custard creams or Bourbon biscuits?
Bourbons every time.
Books or podcasts?
Books.
What we eat or what we think?
Wahoo. Oh, can I pass?
You can pass. Omega-3 or magnesium?
Omega-3.
Chocolate or nut butter?
Chocolate.
Talking or taste buds?
Talking. Oh no. Ooh. Who am I? I don't even know who I am anymore.
This game can have that effect. Right, penultimate question. What feeds your soul? This doesn't have to be something food related, but it's something that makes you feel more uplifted about life.
I really love seeing, you know, when people are pushing for their dreams or they're pushing for their goals. You know, when you'll see a video where someone has, I don't know, like they've not been able to do a cartwheel or play an instrument, and they give you a little kind of montage of their progress and they've done it. Or I saw one on Twitter the other week, which was someone 10 years ago standing outside, I think Pixar or something, saying one day, and then 10 years later she was saying day one. And it was like, wow, you know, that you had this dream, you had this goal, you achieved it. It's that, those little moments of when you see the little spark of the human spirit. I love them.
I love that. That's such a good answer. And finally, what is your death row dinner, starter, main, and dessert?
Starter, I guess I would probably maybe go for some sort of seafood and maybe some mussels something like that, or maybe like just some lovely like hot smoked salmon and a bit of hollandaise and a few little pickles, like something like that. Main would be pasta puttanesca. It's just my favorite comfort food. It's like saucy and like pungent and salty, and also pasta. So that would be my main, or maybe pasta and meatballs, something like that. And then dessert, what's my favorite dessert? I have so many.
So much to choose.
Possibly something like a very good chocolate mousse with a spiced shortbread.
That's the taste of finalists coming out right now. I love it. Kimberly, thank you so much for giving us so much information and also so much joy. It's been such a treat to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Please do check the show notes for links to Kimberly's book, her podcast, and social media. And if you're new here, please do subscribe, rate, and review. I'll see you back here next week for a brand new conversation. And until then, I hope you are well and safe, and I'm sending you lots of love. See you soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.